That, of course, the familiar music from one of the all-time most successful sitcoms, Everybody Loves Raymond. And you know the people who were the faces of that show, Ray Romano and Doris Roberts and Peter Boyle and Patty Heaton and Brad Garrett. But did you know about the guy who was behind the scenes making it all happen? They call him the showrunner in Hollywood. He's one of the creators and the executive producer of that show. His name is Phil Rosenthal, and he has now written about his own life and the experience of running a major network sitcom for several years. The book is called You're Lucky, You're Funny, How Life Becomes a Sitcom. Phil, welcome to KMOX.
Hey, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Very nice to be here.
And, you know, I know you don't have to do this because with all the back-end money you made off that show, you don't have to do anything anymore, do you?
Well, I never did the show for the money, so I'm not doing this for the money either.
By the way, the three kids on the show who we only saw every once in a while, did they get
the
back...
Sweeten family.
The Sweeten family. Did they get back-end deals, too?
They made out okay. You don't have to worry about them.
Okay. So they have money for college.
I think they're okay.
Good. The thing that I always loved about the show, and I was actually watching some clips of it again this morning, was the fact that you based the show on real-life stories. You decided early on, I guess, that you did not want to do a show that was going to be full of topical humor. You wanted to do a show that, to me, rings back to the days of great sitcoms of the 60s, like the Dick Van Dyke Show. Was that part of your inspiration?
Well, that's a great compliment. Yes, we were trying to do a classic, well-made, traditional type of sitcom. And I remember early on, one of the studio executives said, "Those are all words we should be avoiding." And I said, well, what word should we be running towards? And he said, "Hip and edgy."
Oh, no.
And I said, "Well, you got the right guy because I'm Mr. Hip and Edgy." I have no idea how to do that type of show. You know, at the time, this was 1996, and Friends was all the rage, and everybody wanted to just imitate Friends, and I wouldn't know how to do that if I wanted to, right?
Yeah.
So I was the wrong guy to try to make that type of show. All I knew were the shows that I loved growing up, The Honeymooners, Dick Van Dyke, like you mentioned, All in the Family, The Odd Couple, Taxi, right? Mary Tyler Moore. These were all shows that took place on planet Earth and were about real people in real situations, relatable situations, identifiable situations, and that's where all the humor came from. There were not really many topical jokes. Of course, All in the Family had them, but I think what makes All in the Family endure is the characters, not so much the topicality.
And in fact, the show was much more about characters than jokes. Not that it wasn't full of jokes when you guys would sit down in the writer's room and do that, but it was about characters and the simple situations they would get into.
I'll be honest with you, the jokes came last. We would worry most about a good story. And I would say that 90% of what you saw on that show happened to me or to Ray or to one of the other writers.
In fact, you would insist that the writers come in and tell stories about what had really happened in their own lives, right?
Well, that was their homework. Go home early. Have dinner with your family, get in a fight with your wife, and then come back and tell me about it.
Well, and did you have guys who took that a little bit too hard? They actually forced fights with the wife?
Absolutely. In fact, some people were known to keep the fight going a little longer because they needed a longer story.
Honey, we want to do a two-parter. Come on, really go for it.
Right. I don't have a second act. Can I just insult you a little bit more now?
At what point, Phil, did you know that this show had made a connection with the audience? Obviously, when you're producing something, you have an idea. You know what? This seems to be working to me. We're laughing. We're enjoying this. But it's very different when you present it to an audience. At what point did you know, hey, we've cut through there?
Well, that's a great question because you don't know if it's going to. You just think, like, I presented a story in the pilot of something that really happened to me, and it was that I gave my parents the Fruit of the Month Club. And this, for some reason, was a tragedy in my house. My parents reacted to the gift of Fruit of the Month as if it was a box of heads from a murderer. My mother actually said, "I can't talk anymore. There's too much fruit in the house."
She thought you had joined a cult.
That's right. Oh, my God, he got us into some kind of cult that comes every month.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this, I thought, what a good illustration of just how crazy Ray's parents are, right?
Yep.
What I didn't realize was that this was some kind of universal thing, that you can't give a gift to your parents without it blowing up in your face.
Have you heard from other people that they went through the same thing?
I hear from people, we're in 180 countries, I hear from people from India and from Sri Lanka who say, that's my mother.
Now, you mentioned early on here, both in the book and in our discussion here, that the network guy wanted you to be hip and edgy. Tell me about the battle between a showrunner, an executive producer on a show, as you were, and a television network. Is it constant battles?
It is at first, but then if you have any success at all, they'll either start coming all the time as if they're part of it, right? They'll come to the show tapings a lot and hang out as if this is the place that they belong, right? Or they'll just leave you alone because they have bigger fires to put out. It's only at first when they're very worried whether the show is going to be a hit or not that they test everything to death and they note you to death and try to get their imprimatur on the show. And to me, I got the best advice I ever got was do the show you want to do. Because in the end, they're going to cancel you anyway.
And in fact, you, and I thought this was one of the great things in the book, you had no problem saying to them, oh, that's what you want to do? Okay, then I quit.
Well, yes, I had to do that a couple of times. Because, you know, for instance, somebody said that the president of CBS wanted a particular actress to play Deborah. And this particular actress was all wrong. Now, Mr. Moonves, the head of CBS, is a great man, and he has a lot of meanings about a lot of things, and he might have said in a meeting, how about that girl for the part of the wife in that sitcom over there? And then Mr. Network Guy says, I'll be the one who gets her for him. I'll tell the showrunner to cast her, and then I can say, look what I did for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe my job will last another month if I do that. So he insisted to me that this was an edict and that I better follow it or I wouldn't have a show. And I carefully considered the actress for this role and decided I wouldn't have a show with her. So I quit.
That she was just completely wrong for the show.
Completely wrong for the part. She's a very fine actress. She's good. She's good in other things. Completely wrong.
Why don't you just come out and tell her? Tell us the name, Phil. Who are you talking about here?
Well, that wouldn't help anyway. The truth is, if I mentioned the name, you wouldn't know who she was.
It's Joyce DeWitt, isn't it?
She's not very famous. No, it wasn't Joyce DeWitt. But it was a blonde kind of wispy type of actress.
Calista Flockhart.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
You keep guessing, though, and use up all our time. Yes. But no, it would be like Bridget Loves Bernie. You know what I mean? The story of a little blonde girl in a sea of Italian people. Right. It would throw off everything. We needed a tough girl who would stand up to Ray and tell him what to do.
Yep.
So that's how I wrote it, and that's how it had to be. So I was willing to quit over that. So I did.
And then
they caved. I didn't know they would cave, but they did. I wasn't being smart or even brave. I just knew that this wouldn't work and I'd have to move on to something else.
But the real kicker to the story is that Les Moonves wasn't married to the concept of using her in the first place.
Of course not. And when I said, when I explained to him my reasons, he said, oh, it was just an idea.
How did Brad Garrett end up becoming Robert?
Well, that's a good question. I based the thing on Ray's real brother, who really is a police sergeant, who really is older than Ray and jealous of him, and he's naturally shorter than Ray in real life. And I thought, that's funny. The older brother who's jealous of his younger brother, who literally has to look up to his younger brother, right? I thought that was funny. And then this talking tree came into the audition. And I thought, well, here's another way to go. And then he opened his mouth, and those very low tones came out, and I fell over laughing like everybody else. And then, you know, it was so much better than we had imagined the part could be.
Now,
what Brad brought to it.
When you have two terrific stand-ups, both Ray Romano and Brad Garrett are guys who have been going out on stage in front of a microphone for a long time, writing their own material, and in Brad's case, writing for people like Rodney Dangerfield and others through the years. How hard is it for them to accept you're going to write their words for them?
They were both great about it, and of course they both could ad lib, and we would do probably, you know, second takes of the material in front of the audience, and we would switch out jokes because, as I said, the jokes were the things that we thought of last, and we would just switch out jokes if it wouldn't affect the story. You know, and they were both great at coming up with stuff, and all the writers love to pitch in and try to change it up in front of the studio audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see many of those other takes if you get the DVD sets. I'm not trying to sell you a DVD, but that's, if you wanted to see those kinds of things, that's where they are.
Yeah, I've seen some of those, and it especially looks like Brad Garrett liked to go off, but Peter Boyle seemed to have a little bit of a problem with that.
Peter Boyle was fine with it, too. He loved when the guys would play.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. He loved to laugh more than anybody.
Do you have anything to do with Brad's new show on Fox?
I'm afraid not, no.
Did he call you? Did he ask advice?
No.
Did you two consider getting into the business of doing another show after Everybody Loves Raymond?
Yes. In fact, we had a spinoff. Very good idea for a spinoff that CBS did not want.
So CBS didn't want a Robert and Amy show?
Nope.
How come?
My personal opinion
is
that they wanted to go younger this year. And that's evidenced by what they did pick up.
But it's funny that you say that because they also wanted to go hip and edgy. And you proved them wrong about that.
You have to take it up with them. I will not say anything bad about them because they gave me a very nice life.
I don't want you to say anything bad about him either because I still work for Les Moonves. He's still,
oh, okay.
You know,
so we're both going to say nice things.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean them. He was very loyal to us and very great to us. And it was, you know, we weren't a hit out of the box when we premiered on Fridays at 8:30. CBS hadn't had a hit in that time slot since Gomer Pyle.
Mm-hmm.
But Les Moonves personally believed in the show. And he moved us to Monday night and gave us a shot there.
And putting you in between, what was it? I'm sorry, go ahead.
After that one note about that actress, which he then said it was just an idea, he never gave us a note again.
Nice.
He believed in the show. He supported the show. And so I have nothing but nice things to say about him, no matter what their business strategy is from now on.
And he was nice to put you in that comedy hammock between Cosby and Murphy Brown on Monday nights, and that helped launch you. And then you became the stars of Monday nights, which was great, that's why I'm so curious. I would just think that after what you had done for the show and for the network, CBS must have been just knocking on the door. Phil Rosenthal, you have to do more TV for us.
It's a changing world. I'm sure I'm welcome at CBS, but it has to fit their business needs.
Let me take
I can't explain what those needs are, I admit to being baffled by the whole industry. I think that Everybody Loves Raymond would have a very hard time getting on the air today.
How so? Why?
Because everything is skewing younger. And but you see that there's not that many sitcoms on television at the moment.
Right.
Everything is either a reality show or a serialized drama. And by the way, I love some of these serialized dramas. I just think there's too many of them. You know, there's so many. I mean, I can't follow everything. Something's got to go. And so I've told my children that I won't be able to see them that much anymore. There's too many other lives I'm following now.
I completely understand.
Happen on Prison Break?
I want to talk to you about a couple of other projects and a couple of other names that come up in the book. And one of them, there's a sentence in here that just makes me absolutely jealous of you, and that is, so we had lunch with Johnny Carson.
Oh, that was nice.
Please, as a longtime Carson fan, tell me at least a little bit about lunch with Johnny Carson.
Well, I did. I wrote jokes for President Clinton for 8 years of his administration, and the last thing I did was I directed a video that he was in, a comedy video, actually, that he showed at his last White House correspondence dinner. And the video was about 5 or 6 minutes, and it got a lot of attention because the president was so fantastic in it. And a friend of mine said to me, I have a friend who saw that video and asked me where he could get a copy of it. And I said to him, well, you can have lunch with the guy who made it. And would you like that? And he said, yes. And I said, who is it? And he said, Johnny Carson. So I got to go have lunch with Johnny Carson. And I brought Ray with me because, you know, to me, he's the greatest host ever. He's like, you know, a father figure. But to a comedian, this is now like meeting God.
Yes.
Right. So I took Ray, and we went to a restaurant called Shotzi's on Main, and Johnny had his office in that building in Santa Monica, California. And we went, and he took us up in his office, and we saw his office, and it had all the TV guide covers that he had ever been on, and they covered the entire wall of one thing.
Mm.
We chatted with him, and he looked great. He had been out of public circulation for about 8 years at this point. This was the year 2000, I guess, right? And then we went downstairs, and we had a two-hour lunch, and he just was fantastic. And we would bring up stuff from The Tonight Show that we remembered, and he would do the bits for us at the table.
Oh, man!
And it was just, it was like, it was surreal. You couldn't even believe that you were having this conversation. He gave us, what was the great advice that he gave us? He said, you know, he hated when comedians would get political. He didn't like that. He thought, you know, you're not there to give a message. He goes, do your acting, then get the hell off the stage.
Mm-hmm.
That was his attitude.
Which is funny, and because he did so much political humor on The Tonight Show. Did he mean...
It wasn't preachy. He was making fun.
Right.
There was nothing wrong with that. That's part of the act. He meant when the comedians got serious.
Oh, I see.
You see?
Yeah.
He didn't like that. And he stayed out of all that.
Had Ray done the Carson show, Phil?
Oh, sure. Sure.
And so was this an unusual feeling for, I mean, obviously for you, it was you're meeting God. For Ray, was it, okay, well, yeah, I've been with Carson before.
He hasn't been with Carson. He never was with Carson. He came out once. He did the show once. He did the thing. Carson gave him the thumbs up from the seat, right? And
yeah.
Then he went off stage.
Oh,
I don't think he met Carson ever.
So
you know what I mean? He didn't go over to the couch. He didn't go over.
So this was really special for him, too.
This was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. What a thrill for me to be able to bring Ray with me and make his life great. Too.
Absolutely.
It meant a lot to me, but I know it meant a hell of a lot more even to Ray. But boy, we'll never forget that. By the way, I did spent a week in the White House with President Clinton, right? And I wrote down a lot of what happened because look where I was, right?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you something. After that lunch with Carson, I found that I wrote a lot more about that than I did about the week with the president, because when you think about it, there have been several presidents.
True. Only one Johnny.
That's right.
Yeah. Now the other, of course, part of that Daily Double is David Letterman, who you worked for. His company, Worldwide Pants, produced, or co-produced anyway, Everybody Loves Raymond.
Right. It was a co-production of Worldwide Pants, Letterman's company, and Home Box Office.
Now, how did you get involved with Letterman?
Well, Ray was struggling for about 12 years as a stand-up, and he finally got his shot on the David Letterman show. And after that 1 6-minute appearance, Letterman said there should be a show for this guy. And so they set about looking for a writer to create a show for Ray. And I got the job.
There's more to that story, Phil.
Well, I had to go to New York and interview with Dave. That was strange. You want to hear about that?
I do. I want to hear about your first time in David Letterman's office.
Okay. Well, you go to his office, and there he is. It's after a taping, and you go upstairs at the Ed Sullivan Theater, and he's wearing his sweatsuit and a baseball hat and glasses, and he's smoking a cigar. And he says, come on in, and he says, have a seat. Now, when you go into his office, the desk is facing the wrong way. In other words, you enter and you're behind his desk.
Huh.
So that's odd, right? And he gestures for me to sit at the desk. I said, not behind the desk. He said, absolutely behind the desk. So I sit there, and him and two producers sit on the other side like it's my desk and my meeting. So the first thing I said was, I'd like to throw you all the hell out of my office. And it was odd because he had heavy metal music playing on the stereo, very loud. I mean, blasting. It was so loud that you had to yell to be heard.
Wow.
For 20 minutes. For 20 minutes. He didn't turn it down. He just leaned in his chair up against the wall and smoked a cigar, and I remember he gave me very good advice. This was the advice. You ready?
Yep.
Just don't embarrass us.
That's it?
That was it. I thought, wow, that's great. I'm going to send my kid off to school with that every morning.
Well, I think it's safe to say you pretty much fulfilled that advice in the 9 years of Raymond.
I tried not to. I hope we didn't embarrass him.
Did he have any say in the show after that meeting?
I would say after that meeting, I spoke to David Letterman. I never saw him again. I spoke to him a grand total in 9 years of 5 minutes on the phone.
So you worked for the guy for nearly a decade, but you spent more time with Johnny Carson than you did with David Letterman.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Phil, I don't know what season it was, somewhere in the maybe like season 3 or 4, you guys did a show in which Deborah Barone, Patty Heaton's character, pretends to have had a boob job done. Having had Patty on this show and talked to her about her own plastic surgery, I know that she's very, pardon the use of the phrase, upfront about what she's had done. Was that what led you guys to do that episode?
Nope. And you know what's funny is she had that procedure done. She came, that was the first show, I believe, of season 4, and she came back to from hiatus having had that procedure done right into the script that we wrote without knowing that she had done that.
Wow.
Yes.
Did she mind talking about that, on having it right up front on a sitcom
What's funny is after you have that procedure, they're much bigger than they are eventually going to kind of become. In other words, there's a little bit of swelling there.
Uh-huh.
So when she pulls the socks out and reveals to Ray that she didn't have it done, we had to cover her up right away because they were still gigantic.
Yeah, she had to grab a bathrobe or something and pull it over her, didn't she?
That's if you look, there you will see that.
All right, a couple of other quick things before we run out of time here.
We were used to covering her up, though, because she was pregnant twice during the course of the series, and at first, you know, you'd have to carry the laundry basket in front, and then you'd put her behind the couch a little bit, and then you'd have to bring a steamship on.
Were you worried in the last season or towards the end that putting Robert and Amy together meant you were jumping the shark?
Do you think so?
No, I don't think so, but I'm sure you had discussions about it inside.
We did, and you know, it's I don't know if people know, but the girl who played Amy is Mrs. Rosenthal. She's my wife.
Yes.
And so it's a very interesting story, actually, how she got that part. You know how she got the part?
I assume you gave it to her.
She slept with the producer. Yeah.
How hard is that, by the way, having a boss around your wife on the job? I've never had that privilege.
Well, you've heard the expression, turnabout is fair play?
Yes.
Well, I get bossed around plenty at home, so she could take a little at work.
All right. I'm running through a bunch of questions here because I want to get a couple more in before we run out of time here. How much does it cost to crash a car into a house on a TV set?
That's a lot of money. Yes, we did that, but we saved a little bit of money by having Peter and Doris actually do the stunt and not have to hire stuntmen. We had them in the car when we pulled it through the house.
That's got to be a one-take deal, right?
Exactly. We did it one time in rehearsal and filmed it just in case, and then we filmed it live in front of the show, and what you see in the show was filmed live one time in front of the audience.
And it worked brilliantly.
They were great. You know, what we love about that is it's silent for a long time after the crash. It's such a shock. But it's not funny until you see the passenger side of the car open and Frank step out, and then the driver's side of the car open and Marie gets out.
Exactly the opposite of what everybody thought. Nice move there. We talked earlier about sitcoms on TV today. NBC has said they're not going to be programming sitcoms or dramas in the first hour of primetime. They're giving it all up for reality shows and other unscripted shows.
Well, I think this glut of reality shows could signal something slightly larger than just a trend, and that is the end of civilization.
What about the end of the sitcom? This, you know, we always hear about these peaks and valleys in comedy. Are we just in one of those valleys now?
Sure, we'll be back. Everything is cyclical, and the moment there's a hit sitcom, the networks will say, hey, run over there and start imitating that now.
Maybe they'll wise up, and instead of saying we have to be young and new, they'll call up Phil Rosenthal and say, let's get him back. He kind of knows how to do this.
Let's get old and cranky.
That's right. I looked on IMDb to see a couple of things you have coming up. You're working on a movie called The TV Set?
I started as an actor in New York. I was a character actor, a comic actor, and I gave it up to write because I was tired of eating tuna fish for dinner every night, right?
Yeah, right.
So, but now people are looking at me and saying, hey, put him in the thing. So I'm doing these movies, and I'm actually on TV tonight. I'm in this Ted Danson show.
Yep.
I play a therapist, and it's my second episode. I did like three already. I said, what happened? Did you run out of actors in Hollywood? I don't understand why they're coming to me.
But at the same time, aren't you working on a show with Jeff Garlin from Curb?
We did a pilot that didn't go, but we're working on other things, and I've got a screenplay that I'm working on and a documentary I'm working on and even an internet idea, plus a couple of sitcom ideas. So I'm not dead yet.
All of this material for what will be the sequel, I'm sure, to You're Lucky, You're Funny, How Life Becomes a Sitcom. Phil,
listen, I want to tell your nice listeners that if they want some free samples of the book and see what the writing is like, they can go to YourLuckyYourFunny.com. And see some of it, and you can even see me. I was on the Today Show and The View this week, and there are clips of me on there. If the women want to see a very beautiful man, there I am.
All right, we'll leave it at that, Phil, and I'll put links up to that stuff on my site, harrisonline.com, as well. And I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Had a good time. Thank you.
Phil Rosenthal, creator and executive producer of Everybody Loves Raymond for 9 hit seasons on CBS. The book is You're Lucky, You're Funny, How Life Becomes a Sitcom. This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.